I'm so glad to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. So I welcome you to this new series on Dogen's Japanese Waka. We may do another short series on Dogen's Chinese Kanji. We'll see. I think so, though. But before we begin, I'd like to look at you instead of the poem. And the amazing fact that you're here, which has so much meaning. Listen to how Dharma Master, I don't know how to pronounce, this is a Chinese name, H-U-A, so I'm going to pronounce it Hui, and it could be Hua, I just don't know. So let's say Hui, Dharma Master Hui, speaks to his students on this subject. And so first he reads a verse from the Sutra of the Buddha. Throughout 10 million kotis of eons, they never hear the Buddha's name, nor do they hear the proper Dharma. Such people are difficult to save. And then he provides a commentary to this. So regarding the first two lines, throughout 10 million kotis of eons, they never hear the Buddha's name. It means that even after 10 millions of kotis of eons have gone by, they've never even heard that word. Why? Their good roots are scanty, nor do they hear the proper Dharma, and his explanation, nor can they not hear the Buddha's name. They do not have it. Not only can they not hear the Buddha's name, but they don't have a chance to listen to lectures explaining the sutras. And so he's talking to his students. Those of you who are able to listen to the sutra lectures all have good roots. People without good roots might come and sit for a second, but they would soon feel like they were sitting on needles. And ouch, they would hurry up and go away. And why is this? It's because they have no good roots that they cannot sit for even a second before running off. And this little passage that I just read to you is from the Lotus Sutra and the commentary by this Chinese Zen master. And he's telling his students to appreciate the fact that they're listening to the Dharma. Not everyone has the good fortune to, or the good karma, to arrive at such a fortuitous place. It means that they have in the past sown good seeds, which are the causes and conditions of being here. So we don't tend to think ourselves in this way. And so I'm presenting this as something that we all need to consider. And there's another lesson from the same Zen master. And that lesson is Shakyamuni Buddha is still speaking the wonderful Dharma Lotus Sutra on Vulture Peak at this very moment. And to help his disciples appreciate the immediacy, he asks them to translate scripture for him. And one of the nuns that he's asked, I'm going to read to you what she says about her experience. I, being the last of the first five disciples that he asked, and the least familiar with Chinese, protested that my Chinese was absolutely not good enough to translate A for the master and B for the Lotus Sutra. And the master calmly overrode my protests with his simple and immediate logic. You'll never learn if you don't start. Why wait? Why not right now? So, and this is what I want you to hear. This is her experience. To my profound good fortune, I complied. Little did I know that by doing so, I would come to experience the lasting immediacy of being there with each unfolding scenario in the Lotus Sutra, just as if I was and am at any given moment there on Vulture Peak, listening to the ongoing Lotus. As I translated for the Master, I was as though at the feet of the Mahasattvas, Maitreya and Manjushri, as they compared portents of the immediate present with those of the timely past. As I translated, I was aware of the urgency with which Shakyamuni Buddha tried repeatedly to stop his disciple Shariputra's request for the Buddha to address the one great matter, like that's life and death, and help his disciples unfold the Buddha's knowledge and vision, show the Buddha's knowledge and vision, awaken to the Buddha's knowledge and vision, and realize the Buddha's knowledge and vision. As I translated, I experienced the profound relief that the Buddha finally agreed to speak and the exhilarating anticipation of knowing that all who listened would gain the unprecedented ability to access their inherent wisdom and to walk all the way to Buddhahood. As I translated, I was amazed to learn that even those who merely placed their palms together or raised a single hand or gave a slight nod of the head in honoring the Buddha images will in due time see countless Buddhas and realize the unsurpassed path themselves. So she's referring to the fact that Shariputra had to request the ultimate truth teachings from the Buddha three times before he complied. And why? The Buddha felt that the ultimate truth teachings, which are not graspable by our minds, that people hearing it in their frustration would criticize the Dharma. And if they did that, it would be very bad karma for them. It would be a big mistake. And so he was reluctant to lay down the causes for them creating a really bad situation for themselves karmically. So that's why, as a skillful means, he began with teachings that were understandable, like the Four Noble Truths. And as a skillful means, he taught other things besides that, that were easy to understand. And it's easy for us to take those teachings for granted and forget how precious it is to be present, to hear them. And most especially, we forget that Shakyamuni Buddha is still this minute teaching the Lotus Sutra on Vulture Peak, like right now. Because time, as we know, doesn't exist. And Shakyamuni, the fact that this is shocking to us, it shows us how far we are from living in the reality of truth. So regarding time, Dogen says that this present moment is only this present moment. It's not past, which is already gone. It's not future, which is not there. And the present moment itself has no length, zero. So therefore, there's no such thing as time. Time's a fiction created in our minds. Yet, Dogen says, within this zero, the entire past is included and the entire future is included. So the present moment, which is zero, generates the past and the future. More importantly, he says that when we are zero, like in Zazen, we are authentic. And so one moment of sitting is becoming one with all things in time and space. And Dogen says, when we are empty, the sound of emptiness sounds forever. When we are empty, the sound of emptiness sounds forever. And because we are zero and one together with all beings, we are living the eternal life of Buddha's eternal life, not the life of being born in this year and die this year. And we have to be careful about this point. I'm going to say this formula and just try to take this in. If we live only for the sake of this person, when we die, we lose everything. If we don't live only for the sake of this person, then our life is a kind of offering, and our life continues even while the five skandhas disappear. It's not about quantity of time, it's about quality of life. And this is the difference between the Bodhisattva way, which is living by vow, which we talked about in our last series, and the ego-centered way of life, that being yourself at the center of all things. So the last word on this subject, in a temple or monastery, before listening to the teacher speak on a sutra or on anything really, they slowly chant the verse for opening a sutra. And I find this verse enormously inspiring. And this is the verse. And they say it really slowly, or they sort of chant it. The unsurpassed, profound, and wonderful Dharma is difficult to encounter in hundreds of millions of eons. I now see and hear it, receive and uphold it. I vow to fathom the Tathagata's true meaning. So moving on to a waka of Dogen's, I want to introduce it first a little bit by saying that though Dogen wrote at least 400 kanji, it's a Chinese form, and I was wrong when I said 200. I just learned that it was maybe only 60 or a little more than 60 waka, Japanese waka. The latter eventually compiled into a book called Verses on the Way from Sancho Peak. It's well known that by Dogen scholars and practitioners that Dogen disparaged the value of literature. And in the Shobo Genzo, one of his fascicles, he wrote, Zen monks these days are fond of studying literature as a grounding to compose verses or write Dharma words. This is wrong. Even if you cannot compose verses, just write what you think in your mind. Even if your style is not sophisticated, write down the Dharma gates, which means entryways to the Dharma. People without mind of awakening will not read it if your writing style is not well polished. But even if the style is embellished and there are excellent phrases in it, such people would only play with the words without grasping the principle behind them. I have been fond of studying literature since my childhood. And even now, I think this sounds a little bit snobby, but even now, I have a tendency to contemplate the beauty in the words of non-Buddhist texts. Sometimes I even refer to the selections of refined literature or other classic texts. Still, I think it is meaningless and it should cease immediately. So Dogen is from a very aristocratic family, and he had the highest form of education available at that time, which is the 13th century. So court literature peaked between the 10th and the 12th centuries. So there was a lot of beautiful writing for Dogen to waste his time on. In the end, he doesn't say not to write poems, but rather that one's poems should not be elevated by worldly standards, such as literary devices and flowery styles. And Okamura Roshi points out, from the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, Buddhist masters have questioned the ability of language to express reality beyond discrimination and conceptualization. And yet these masters all tried to express this reality using language, including Dogen. As he discussed in the Shobo Genzo Fascicle, Being Able to Speak, Dogen never dismissed the importance of expressing reality with or without language. So the critical point here is that Dogen's waka are not intended to be beautiful externally. Rather, they're beautiful in their pointing to a truth. They're basically teaching tools. And since they're short and on the surface easy to understand, and you'll see what I mean by on the surface, they are tremendously useful for studying Dogen, whose Shobo Genzo fascicles can be just like beyond belief difficult. So their handiness as a teaching tool, in fact, was the reason that they got translated from the original Chinese in the first place. And then again, the Japanese ones are also now translated into English. They're terrific teaching tools. And you'll see, so I'm gonna present the first one now. It's number 6 in the series. And it has a long title, and some of them have no titles. And it's all about the teaching point. Poem on the occasion of over a foot of snow falling on the 25th day of the 9th month of the 2nd year of the Dongan era. All of that is to say 1244. Here's the poem. And remember, waka are like 31 syllables. They're all very short. In the month of long nights, it snowed on the bright leaves. Why don't those who see this compose a poem? I'll read it again. In the month of long nights, it snowed on the bright leaves. Why don't those who see this compose a poem? And Okamura Roshi, who translated this waka and says it's one of his favorites, reminds us that Dogen spent most of his life in Kyoto, where the weather is extremely different. And it can snow there, but the snow doesn't hold. But his new monastery, Eheiji, which was, they got there in 43 and they built the monastery. They had to live somewhere else in very bad conditions for a year till it was built. And this poem was composed at the end of the 9th month of the year that they finally moved into the monastery, 1244. And so, just a little background. Dogen lived from 1200 to 1253. And so it was only the final 10 years of his life that he established his own monastery in this snow country. And we learned about this snow country from Ryokan. If you remember, the whole winter, he couldn't leave his grass hut because there was like 10 feet of snow outside. That's how the snow country is. And Basho's poetry has made the North Country, he's fixed the North Country in a very loving place in many people's minds. So Basho, his journey to the North Country, North Road or something, is a very, very famous and wonderful poem. And it's all about this very North Country that Dogen moved from Kyoto to. And so he walks out the door and he sees snow covering everything. And he's like shocked and astonished at his, at its beauty. And I actually had an experience like that once. When I read this poem, I recall one Christmas I went home to visit my mother and stepfather who lived in Falls Church, Virginia, which is right outside of Washington, D.C. And I got there and then I slept the whole night. And when I woke up in the morning, very early, before everybody got up, I opened the door and it was like completely white over the entire vista, including a lake that was across the street. So the lake was covered with snow. All the trees were covered with snow. Everything was covered with snow. And I was preparing to go for a walk. And I did. But I felt really guilty every footstep, marring this incredible oneness of color. And that actually is the point of this poem. The title of the poem, White Snow on Bright Leaves, is this year, it snowed early and it snowed while the leaves were still in their autumn colors. And so he could see the white snow, which is this mono color, covering the fall colors. And so he's, for Dogen, it wasn't just the beauty, it was the meaning of the unity of oneness and individuality. The leaves are individuality and the snow is this oneness. Okamura Roshi explains how this snow comes. He says that in the lengthening nights, normally is the season of changing the changing colors of the leaves, and snow is rare. But this year's snow fell early, and it was still on the leaves. And apparently, the wind's direction changes, and due to the cold air coming in from Siberia, the temperature suddenly dropped. And in this region where Aheiji is located, the snow country faces the Sea of Japan. And one day they'd have 1 foot of snow, and the next day they'd have like 10 feet of snow, and everything became white. And he's saying, oh my God, this is so amazing. Why don't people compose a poem? And especially for him coming from Kyoto, he may never have seen this. And I had that same experience visiting my mother. I had never seen snow cover everything. I had lived with snow, but it never covered everything like that. Again, the point for Dogen was not how gorgeous it was. It was the meaning of the oneness in conjunction with the individuality of everything. And this oneness and individuality that they live together, we've already covered this in the third series when we talked about the Sandokai. And that's, I think that's what the meaning of the word Sandokai is. Oneness and multiplicity live together. And Suzuki Roshi said about that, to find the oneness of joy and suffering, the oneness of the joy of enlightenment within difficulty is our practice. And it's called the middle way. And when there is suffering, there's a joy of suffering or nirvana. And even in nirvana, you can't get rid of suffering. We say nirvana is the complete extinction of desires. But what that means is to have this complete understanding of the middle way and live according to it. And this is Zazen. When you're sitting upright, you're not leaning to one side or leaning to the other. You're right in the middle, and everyone can do this. So there's this story in the Blue Cliff Records, which is a collection of old Zen teachings from China compiled in the 12th century. You may have heard this phrase, the Blue Cliff Records. That's what it is, a compilation of koans from the 12th century. And so this one is particularly charming. A Zen master hears raindrops and he asks his monk, "What is the sound outside?" And the monk says, "It's the sound of raindrops." So the Zen master says, "I wonder if most people make a mistake understanding the raindrop. Because if you say it's the sound of a raindrop, it's not the pure nature of sound. It's something running through your noisy conscious mind." So then the monk says, "How about you? In other words, how do you understand the raindrop sound?" And the Zen master said, "I almost make a mistake," which means if you try to say what the pure nature of sound is, you always make a mistake because the pure nature is not something you can recognize with your conscious mind. So the Zen master almost made a mistake by answering in words, but he didn't. So there was no mistake. Almost means that the pure nature of the raindrop sound and the Zen master's own pure nature are not separated. Their pure natures are interconnected. So this case shows the double aspect of our existence. And I want to tell you a story that illustrates this thing. This point very well. So most of you know that I'm a poet and that I read a lot each night. And one night I heard all this noise from upstairs from a new family that just moved in. And it was the yapping of one of these small dogs whose yap had this kind of shrieking edge to it. And the dog was just yapping with its shrieking edge, like constantly. I think it was excited that they were moving into a new place. But I thought, oh my God, this is going to be my life from now on. I'm going to have to live with this shrieking dog. And then I remembered, but you know, there are laws around this. There are dog laws, and you can say something to your neighbor if their dog's barking bothers you. And I was all ready to look up the laws and write a letter to my neighbor when the following morning I just happened to be reading in the first two series of these talks, and my eye fell on the following paragraph by Suzuki Roshi. "Sound is different from noise. Sound comes from your practice. Noise is more objective. If you strike a drum, the sound is the sound of your own subjective practice, and it is also the sound that encourages everyone. So sound is both subjective and objective. I may think the bird is singing over there, but when I hear the bird is me already. Actually, I'm not listening to the bird. The bird is here in my mind already, and I am singing with the bird. Peep, peep, peep. If you think while you are studying, the blue jay is singing above my roof, but its voice is not so good, that thought is noise. When you are not disturbed by the blue jays will come right into your heart, and you will be a blue jay, and the blue jay will be reading something, and then the blue jay will not disturb your reading. When we think, the blue jay is over my roof and should not be there, that thought is a more primitive understanding of being. That thought is a more primitive understanding of being. Because we lack practice, we understand things in that way. That's what Suzuki Roshi says. He says, living in the realm of duality, we must have a good understanding of the absolute. And he says it may be a deity, but we don't have a particular idea of deities. And later he says, when you don't know, this is being in the dark, absolute stage. When you don't know what you're doing, actually you're acting fully with a full mind. When you're thinking, you're not yet working. It's like when you're hearing, when you're in the noise part, you're not yet working. When you're in the sound part, you can act with your full mind. When you start to work, both the dark side and the light side are there. When you're in your full mind, when you're hearing sound, both are there. When you're actually practicing the Buddha way, there is a light side and a dark side. And the relationship between lightness and darkness is the Ari relationship, like the relationship between skin and body. You cannot actually say which is skin and which is body. And I'm going to end with this literally beautiful, I think I've read this before, quote from Dogen. Just sit back and listen. It's so beautiful. On the same subject, and this is from the Genjo Koan. Enlightenment is like the moon reflected in the water. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. Although its light is wide and great, the moon is reflected even in a puddle an inch wide. The whole moon and the entire sky are reflected in dewdrops on the grass, or even in one drop of water. Enlightenment does not divide you, just as the moon does not break the water. You cannot hinder enlightenment, just as a drop of water does not hinder the moon in the sky. The depth of the drop is the height of the moon. Each reflection, however long or short its duration, manifests the vastness of the dewdrop and realizes the limitlessness of the moonlight in the sky. We gain enlightenment like the moon reflecting in the water. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. So here are some of the most important points. First, if we live only for the sake of this person, when we die, we lose everything. If we don't live only for the sake of this person, then our life is a kind of offering, and our life continues even when the five skandhas disappear. Second, to find the oneness of joy and suffering, the oneness of the joy of enlightenment within difficulty is our practice, Suzuki Roshi said. This is called the middle way. So the middle way is to have both joy and suffering and the oneness of joy of enlightenment within difficulty. Third, the darkness does not mean that nothing is there. The darkness, or the world of the absolute, is beyond our thinking, but not different from our human world. Darkness includes light, and light includes darkness. They are the same, two sides of the same coin, only one side is easier to see. Fourth, when you are not disturbed by blue jays will come right into your heart, and you will be the blue jay, and the blue jay will be reading something, and then the blue jay will not disturb your reading. You can substitute yapping dog for blue jay. And fifth, when you don't know what you're doing, actually you're acting fully with a full mind. When you are thinking, you're not yet working. And some points for reflection during the week. And I so hope that you take these seriously and really work with them in order to integrate what you're hearing. You know, we can hear something, but we're just hearing it. And it's the beginning. But then when we work with it and integrate it, it actually affects, it comes out through our behavior. And that's what we want. We want our behavior to show our understanding. That's why I give you these reflection points. The first point is regarding this formula. If we live only for the sake of this person, when we die, we lose everything. If we don't live only for the sake of this person, then our life is a kind of offering and our life continues even when the five skandhas disappear. And it's not about quantity of life, of time, it's about quality of life. And this is the difference between the Buddha way, living by vow, and the ego-centered way of life. And the question for you is, how does Dogen's view on the two ways of living, ego-centered and living by vow, affect your life personally? How do you bring that in? What happens in your life when you hear these two kinds of ways of living? That's for your reflection this week. And secondly, regarding the passage from the Lotus Sutra and the commentary by Chinese Zen master Hui, telling his students, one, to appreciate the fact that they are listening to the Dharma, two, that not everyone has the good fortune or good karma to arrive at such a fortuitous place, and three, that it means they have in the past sown good seeds, which are the causes and conditions of this opportunity. All of this is about you. Can you describe what you feel when you hear this auspicious truth about yourself, who are the same as his students? So how do you feel when you hear that? That's the second point for reflection. And the third is to hear that Shakyamuni Buddha is still teaching the wonderful Dharma Lotus Sutra on Vulture Peak, like right now as I'm speaking. It's a little shocking, but it simply shows the truth that there is no such thing as time. The nun translating experienced this directly. Have you? And I ask you to speak on this subject, to speak on the subject of your experience with this true fact that there's no such thing as time. Like the nun experienced the Buddha saying the Lotus Sutra right on Vulture Peak right now as she was translating. She was translating as he spoke. You know, sometimes, well, I experienced this a lot when my Tibetan Buddhist teacher who didn't speak English, as he spoke, a translator translated it into English. And I'm laughing because sometimes he didn't speak English, but sometimes he would correct the translator. Like, who knows? I mean, he was an enlightened being, so I guess that's how he knew the translator wasn't translating into English correctly, and he'd correct him. So go figure. Let's see. All right. The fourth point is, this is for you to reflect on. Do you agree with Dogen that studying literature is meaningless and should cease immediately? Do you agree with that? Dogen feels it strongly. And fifth, how can we perceive and express the oneness of everything within the myriad things we encounter? How can we do this? I wonder if there are questions.
Gil, so the first question that we have is, what are the five skandhas?
The five skandhas are what we're made of. In Buddhist understanding, we're made of five different the five things that compose a human being are form, which means our body form, sense perceptions, like we see things, we touch things, we taste things, although those sense perceptions. So form, sense perceptions, cognition, thinking, mental formations, which means like ideas and dreams and fantasies, and consciousness. So I'm going to say those again. Form, sense perception, cognition, mental formations, and consciousness. And they're all impermanent. The first one is physical form, like our body, and the other four are mental. But the Buddha scholars over centuries have determined that these five factors are what make up a human being, a whole individual. And examining them one by one, they found them all to be impermanent. And so we are beyond a doubt impermanent. But to my mind, we don't even need any of that. All we have to do is look in the mirror and we know we're impermanent. Or look at the person that you love the most in the world, and you know that we're impermanent. That's what the five skandhas are. Things are constantly changing. And these five skandhas constantly change into something else. Thank you.
The next question that we have is, I've never thought of myself as having good karma. Looking over my life, it has been full of obstacles and failures. I'm always changing my mind, and it's hard for me to know what's right and wrong. When I'm told how the fact that I am present at these talks means that I have sown good deeds, I almost can't believe it. From the looks of my life, I definitely have not sown good deeds.
I definitely felt the same thing most of my life. And this same Tibetan Buddhist teacher that I just told you about, who could correct, who didn't know English, but correct, he could correct the translator when he didn't translate something quite perfectly. And then they talk in Tibetan, and then the translator would translate it a little differently. This same enlightened Rinpoche told me that even though it was difficult now, that it would get better. And it did. It did get better. And I want to say that for you, sitting here in this assembly, asking this question, which all these questions that you ask and why we encourage your questions, is that you're asking for the Dharma. You're asking for the Dharma. And I wanna say that so that already it's getting better for you already. That said, this is not about, these talks are so great. It's not about that. It's about, this is the Dharma. Whether the talks are great or not, it's the Dharma. And you're present and even asking questions, encouraging teachings of the Dharma. And that's what's important. And already your life has changed for the better. And if you really seriously did even work with some of the reflection questions, not to mention do zazen, you will feel a change on a cellular level. On a cellular level, you will feel a change. You will no longer be the person who feels like your karma is so bad that there's no good seeds there. We already know, since you're here, that there are, because in Buddhism, everything is about causes and conditions. That's why we don't have a God, because there's no causes and conditions for a God. So that's why we don't talk about that. But there are causes and conditions for you being here. And so that's what I'm saying. And that's what I was talking about in the beginning. There's tremendous good fortune involved in your being here, and you're listening to the Dharma. And it's an amazing event, because when you think of all the beings who have never heard the Dharma and don't even know what the word Dharma means, they never heard the word Buddha even, you can consider how amazing it is. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Next question we have is, could you explain the part about, because we are zero, we are one together with all beings. We're living the eternal life of Buddha's eternal life, not the life of being born in this year and die in that year. I sort of understand, but not really.
The reason you don't understand is that it's an ultimate truth, and ultimate truths aren't graspable with the mind. So our conventional understanding is that we live, you know, 50 to 100 years, let's say, 80 to 90 years or so. But the ultimate truth is there's no such thing as time. So the Buddha is giving his Lotus Sutra talk right now. And when we, during Zazen, drop off body and mind, and we're sitting Zazen, and you don't know you're doing that, but that's what happens in Zazen. And we become zero, which means we become together with all beings. We're no longer this individual. We're a part of the interconnected, codependent arising of all beings. And another way of saying this is, we are the Buddha, and the Buddha has eternal life, not 80 or 90 years. And so the truth becomes increasingly accessible as we practice, but you don't need to worry about it. You don't need to understand this, actually. It's fine. Don't worry about it. I'm free associating right now to something I heard Okamura Roshi say. I was listening to a talk of his the other day, and he said, referring to the interconnected, the codependent arising of the interconnected universe, he said, everything is there in the beginning, you know, the Big Bang or whatever. Everything is there, he said. And so when I die, nothing is lost. And when I'm born, nothing is added. And I was shocked. But then immediately, of course, that's true. Because we're a part of this interconnected net of, it's called Indra's net in Buddhism. And each little knot on the net is, is an individual. But we just swim in this net, and birth and death are just one knot, you know, goes here and one knot goes there, and it's just all one movement, really. And so nothing is lost and nothing is gained. I had to step back to hear that, I don't know if it relates to your question, but I just kind of associated off to that when you asked the question. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Gail. Another question that we just got. So there are two more questions. One you sort of answered. I'd still ask the question. And if you want to add anything, then you can. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next one. When you say that there is no time, are changing, you saying that everything is happening at the same time right now. Is Buddha still speaking, or is the nun just experiencing the Buddha speaking by reading about it?
You forgot about the second part. There's only the present moment, and there's no past because the past is already gone, and there's no future because it's not here yet. And the present moment has no length, it's zero. So that's why there's no time. And at the same time, the present moment contains all of our future and all of our past. So both are happening simultaneously. So there's two sides to this coin. There's both no time and our present moment. There's no time and the present moment, both. That's the Buddhist understanding. Remember Suzuki Roshi's book called Not Always So? there's a book called Not Always So by Suzuki Roshi, because nothing is always so in Buddhism. There's always, well, there's this, but then there's also that. And they're often opposites. And that's why Buddhism is difficult. But it's really expressing the conventional truth that we know and live every day, and the ultimate truth that we only hear and we only, through Zazen and through practice, we increasingly get a feeling for. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the next question is, I've been studying the five skandhas lately. It recently clicked for me that of these five kinds of stuff that composes us, a self is not among them. Phenomena are constantly changing, constantly emerging. When I keep this in mind, when I'm talking to someone, it makes me feel more tender, open, and grateful.
Yes, it does create compassion. You know, the self is not among them. And in Buddhism, there is no self. So this goes back to, I don't know so much about Indian philosophy, but the Atman is the self. And so Buddhism is very emphatic about there's no Atman, there's no self. And I guess it was a big deal long ago when Buddhism started asserting that. And Atman was a very big part of the philosophy of many people. So it was kind of, opposite sides. It was like a conflict. But when you say you can't find a self among the skandhas, that's correct. That's correct. In Buddhism, there's no self. And so when we focus our life, when we have this self-centered life, it's not even real. So there's all kinds of reasons, and most importantly, the one I just gave you today of when we live a non-self-centered life, our life becomes an offering, and it actually continues as the offering, and as the offering, and maybe even as a blessing. It continues in this interconnected universe. I think that's all. And before I end, I want to be sure to thank my team, Brian and Sahar and Brendan, who work very hard behind the scenes to make these talks possible. Please, we all must not forget this. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next week.